With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. It's been a while. We skipped a couple weeks because we needed a break.
Yeah,
a couple. My name is Dina Ray Ramos.
Yeah, my name is Amanda Nduka. We needed to take a breather, but we're back. And Dino, tell them who we're back with.
So in honor of the season 18 premiere, I believe, of Top Chef, we have the lovely Padma Lakshmi. Oh God, we had such a glorious conversation. Laughter, tears.
No, it really, literally, we talked about, I mean, obviously she's been the host since the season two of the series. She's Emmy nominated for her hosting gig. She's great, you guys. She had so much, I mean, she took us to school. We had a great conversation. She told us, I mean, they're because of the pandemic, they had to make some changes to the season, which is going to be really interesting. We talk about that. We talk about just her career and her background, her upbringing. She's such an interesting upbringing.
Yeah. Like, I didn't realize a lot of the things she said. I mean, I didn't know that she was supposed to host this first season. That may be out there already.
Yeah.
But then she couldn't, so they got someone else. She's a cookbook author, Taste the Nation on Hulu, star of Glitter.
Yeah. we get into a little bit of, you know, what's been happening with our Asian brothers and sisters and all the hate that's going on, all the violence that's been happening, which is very, very sad and needs to end now. But we talk about that, and she has a lot to say about that too. Like I said, Padma is somebody that we've been wanting to get on for a while, and she's just a gem, you guys. Like she does it all. Like, she's superwoman in my eyes.
She is, basically.
Okay, without further ado, here is Padma. Padma, welcome to Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. We are so, so happy that you could join us today. And of course, you are the host of one of the biggest shows on TV, Top Chef, which is coming back in April. But before we get into that, we here like to sort of talk about, everybody has a very unique story, especially like people of color in this business. And we like to get a little bit of an insight into your story and coming up in this business. So, I mean, you've done it all. You've modeled, you've acted, you're the host of Top Chef, you're a cookbook author. I think your first cookbook came out in 1999, which is amazing. But where did all of this interest come from for you? Where did your love for food, your love for performing, where did that all stem for you?
For me, it all stems really with the women in my family. I grew up in the kitchen cooking with my mom, my grandmother, my aunts, many of them. You know, in Indian culture, we all live in joint families. And, you know, I went from sort of being a latchkey kid in New York to going back every summer to my grandparents' house and living with 8 or 10 people in a 2-room house in South India. So, you know, and we only had 2 burners, and my grandmother didn't really get a fridge until she was in her 30s. So she never knew what to do with it. So there was always fresh food being made. And you have 8 to 10 mouths to feed. That's a lot of food to cook. So for me, that's where all the power was. That is where all the decisions were made in the kitchen. That's where the family gossip was shared. That's where, you know, the seat of power in our family was in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So from a very young age, as a toddler at 3, at 4, I was already, you know, beginning to shell peas or break the ends off beans or just simple things like that. And I think I experienced the world through food. That is to say, you know, I remember nights by what I cooked. I judge people by, you know, if they like to eat. You know, they don't have to be good cooks, but if they just enjoy food and things like that. So I process the world through my sense of taste and smell. Well, through all my senses, because I'm a very sensorial person, you know, and I think cooking in and of itself should be done with all of your senses, your sense of touch, your sense of smell, but also your sense of hearing. I can tell whether something is done by how it sounds in the pan.
Wow, that's like a mutant power. That's
No, I was gonna ask you, because I mean, you didn't go to culinary school, but you have such an expansive knowledge of food, and not just, you have from food from different places around the world. You know how things should taste, you know how things should look. Where did you gain that from? It was just traveling.
I was very lucky enough to be a model. You know, I was discovered in my last semester of college. And I don't think I would have the knowledge that I have today if I didn't have the opportunity to travel all over the world as a model like I did. You know, my mom is a nurse, my stepdad's a plumber. So there's no way I would have had the resources to have that kind of education and exposure, which I received because I was in all these weird, funky places. And the first place I would go is the food markets. You know, I mean, I love a good open air fruit and vegetable market, but also like in Morocco, the spices, you know, to go to the souks in Istanbul and things like that. I think that was the greatest benefit, other than paying off my college loans, but that was the greatest benefit that modeling gave me, is the power to travel. And I was always straddling two cultures. And so that also taught me the culinary traditions of a Southeast Asian culture, India in my case, and also American culture and cuisine, because, you know, I'm basically an American kid. I came here when I was 4, but there's so much code switching that goes on for immigrants as soon as you cross that threshold of your home, that I think at the time it was difficult. It made for a really difficult childhood, because I was never at home in one culture completely, and always kind of a little bit of an outsider in both. But now as an adult, I also think it taught me adaptability, and hopefully it also taught me empathy, and that, you know, people have different systems and ways of thinking. You know, I think we all like to think our way is the right way, but really no way is the right way. It's just what is the best for the situation or context you're talking about.
And then you talked a little bit about like sort of how your cultural identity and upbringing influence your career path. Very interesting. Just a curiosity, what did your parents think about you getting into entertainment? Just because you know being first generation, I mean, we all sort of have that same
stamp that's put on us whenever we be a engineer, right? Accountant,
like, yeah, so I'm,
or
I'm
medicine.
What was it like for you, like sort of being, you know, in a house like that and pursuing a career in entertainment?
It was hard. I'm the only person in entertainment in my family. And when I say my family, I'm Indian, so that means like hundreds of people, my extended family. I do have a couple of writers, good writers in my family, but they were sort of in my grandmother's generation and my mother's generation, not in mine. Yes, everyone in my family is either an engineer or in the medical profession in some capacity. And so when I said, well, I kind of got around it. When I said I was going to college, this was the truth, I was going to major in psychology. So I was planning on becoming a psychologist, which, you know, they were fine with. But then when I auditioned for my first play, I was very involved in theater in high school. That's when I realized, wait a minute, you know, I really love this and I'm really not enjoying intro to psych. So I switched my major, and that's when the shit kind of hit the fan, because, you know, I didn't volunteer that, but somebody asked me, my family, and I told them, well, I switched it because I love books and I love the theater. So I'm going to be a theater major and a literature major, American literature major. And they were like, but what skill will you learn? Like, what does that qualify you to do? And I said, well, at least, I said, worst comes to worst, I'll be a substitute teacher. I thought I was going to be a drama school teacher who was going to spend a lot of her off time auditioning. You know, as a brown woman in Hollywood, it was not easy to even get your name on the list to get the audition, never mind get the part, you know. And I don't feel that I'm any less American than anyone else. You know, I was talking to you on the phone and I said my name was Linda Smith. You may not necessarily question that, but because I have a foreign sounding name, you know, and brown skin, I knew what auditions there were because I had girlfriends who were in my theater school who got those auditions. And I would always go to my agent when I was lucky to finally get an agent and be like, well, can I go up for this? You know, my friend is going up for that. And they're like, oh, you know, they're not going ethnic with this role. And I was like, what does that even mean? You know?
Yeah, it's just so wild how, in a way, none of that has changed. it's kind of fucked up, but you know, I think.
It is better, it is better. Look, you have.
It's better,
yeah. You didn't have Mindy Kaling 20 years ago. Right. You know,
that's
you
true.
Didn't have Never Have I Ever. You didn't have Fresh Off the Boat. Mm. You didn't have Blackish. You didn't have, I don't know why I'm only talking about ABC shows, but you know. like Priyanka Chopra, you know, is different because she was already a Bollywood star, but even her crossing over would have been unthinkable when I was in my 20s, frankly. Yeah. I just didn't see it, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm happy that it's changing. I just think it's good for business also. You know, I've had Top Chef for 15 years and I'm so proud of that show and it's in 60 countries and everything. It was so hard for me to get Taste the Nation made, you know? And you would think that wouldn't be so. Like, I'm quite well known in the food and television world. And yet it was really difficult. Like 7 different people turned down Taste the Nation before Hulu said yes. And thank God they said yes because I think it was destined, and I'm happy that those other people said no, because I think I honestly got the best partner I could get with Hulu. Mm. You know, they've been so supportive and they really are great at giving me autonomy, giving me the support I need, but also trusting me as an auteur to create a show that's not by committee, which often many shows are. And I think, you know, my hat's off to them.
That's very interesting.
Chef, also, but like that show is fully formed, you know, it's different when you're starting, when you're trying to sculpt the mist and try to create something out of nothing.
I mean, like, I will say one thing. I'm going to admit, like, right before I got up on this call, the two shows that I have been watching during this pandemic, I alternate between RuPaul's Drag Race and Top Chef. I honestly watched Top Chef from the most recent season to the very first season. Which is quite a journey.
Just the wardrobe alone on me.
Before I hopped on this call, I was watching the episode of Drag Race where you were a judge in season 10, which is fun. But, you know, Top Chef, when it first started, I remember it was in San Francisco. I think I was living in San Francisco at that time, but then it went on to other seasons. But now, it's like exploded into so many seasons. It's this Emmy Award winner. It's this phenomenon. When you signed on to Top Chef, were you just like, oh, cool, I got a job? Did you think that it would become what it has become?
The short answer is absolutely not. I was involved. I had pitched a show to Bravo that they thought was too niche or highbrow. And they said, but we are working on this other show. You know, we would love you to be part of that. And I said, sure. And so I was involved in talking to Bravo about Top Chef before it ever aired. Then what happened is that I was still making my living as an actor, and I got a mini series with Sean Bean called Sharp's Challenge, which is a British production. And so, you know, I said yes to the job. I auditioned, I got the part, I said yes. And then Top Chef was like, okay, we're ready to film. And this is when we're going to film. And I said, I'm sorry, I said that I would, you know, do this movie. And I didn't feel able to like back out of that movie. And so they didn't want to wait for me. So they got somebody else to do the first season. So I got to see what they did first season. And then they, you know, second season, they said, well, are you free now? And I said, yes. But so I was aware of the show. But I did Top Chef because I thought it would be a nice little boost for my cookbook. You know, I never realized it would be anything near what it is. And it's so funny because that cookbook, which came out in 2007, finally, now 14 years later, they've reissued this cookbook just last week.
Which
is so strange because, you know, that was another girl. I mean, that was me in another lifetime, in a, you know, another situation for so many reasons. And so it's nice that the things that I've been saying are finally now people are, you know, catching up to, and I'm excited that that little cookbook is having, you know, it's renaissance, I guess. I mean, it's unheard of for books to be, you know, like most books reissued after 14 years. So it's kind of nice. Mm.
Cool. Yeah.
And so the new season comes out April 1st.
Yes.
Correct? Yeah. Yeah. Very soon. Next week. Yes. Or this week. Yeah, no, actually, tomorrow. This is coming out this week. Yeah. This is coming out tomorrow. But it's in Portland, you know. So wait, do you, and like, you know, Tom and everyone, do y'all commiserate on what cities you want to go to? Or, and, you know, what made y'all choose Portland? Because I've noticed during the seasons, like, there is kind of a significance with each city. Like, even if it's kind of small, you know, when you, you know, like, big. When you went to Austin or you went to DC, yeah.
It's big.
And, I mean, yeah, so how does that process
go? Well, food is very regional, okay? And so we don't think of American food as regional, but it really, really is. And so the city, the reason we change the city we go to every season is because that city and the things that are made there and the people who live there and what grows there locally is very, very important to that season and those challenges. Like the challenges are informed by where we are. So that's why we change the show every season. Otherwise it wouldn't be as interesting. And it's a food show. You know, food is tied to the land. And so we usually, it's not up to us, you know, it's not all up to us. We do give suggestions, and I've been, you know, I wanted to go to Portland for a long time. It has a great food scene. We had been to Seattle, but that was a while ago. And, you know, we never know which city is going to pan out. There's so many factors in why we go to a city, including obviously financial. That it's not up to Tom and it's not up to me, but we do give suggestions. We, you know, I've been wanting to go back to say Atlanta or we've never been to Atlanta. I want to go to Atlanta or Philadelphia. Like I want to, you know, for next season, go back to the Eastern Seaboard because I had such a great time in Charleston. And so a lot of different things go into it. We had been talking about Portland for a number of years and we just hadn't gotten to it yet. And when COVID hit, you know, I think the feeling was, well, if we go to somewhere where the natural beauty and being outdoors is such a part of the culture, that will be good. But COVID protocols, it will keep us safer. And we also wanted to be in a less densely populated city than say San Francisco or New York.
Do you have a region that sticks out for you like throughout all the seasons?
You mean that I personally love?
Yeah.
New Orleans.
Okay.
Oh yeah. God, that was such a good season. I loved that season.
Not even for the food, honestly, because the food was really heavy and you know, that's lovely when you're on vacation or you're going to visit your grandma, but when you're there for 6 weeks eating as much as I am, it's really hard on your system. But I loved filming there. You know, Krishna, my daughter, was really tiny. She was like 4, I think. And it was just a magical time. And I never go out when I'm filming because I literally like work 16-hour days every day, and I just don't have time. I mean, it gets better second half of the season because there's less contestants to get through, but I work every day. But in New Orleans, I went out more than I would. And sometimes I just went out alone. Like when I say that's not weird, except I went to a club alone, like a live music place. I don't remember the name, but a reggae bar. I just decided, I was like, you know what? I'm not tired. I still have my TV makeup from the quick bar. I'm going out. And I literally just like slipped on my shoes and went out and like just sat there and listened to reggae music for a good 2 hours and ate a pupusa and came home. Like, you know, and
nice. Yeah.
And I don't really, you know, I don't do that anymore. I don't go out just like willy nilly. I don't have the time. It's like sleep is a premium when I'm in production. And I loved New Orleans for that. And people don't think of New Orleans as kid friendly, but it really was. And we had a great time. So for my family, my daughter and I, we have a lot of great memories from there too.
I have a question. This is kind of random. Well, not really random, but so whenever you're filming the show, you said you work 16 hours a day. And obviously like there's a bunch of stuff to eat and to taste. Do you ever eat outside of like the, okay.
Like by the end of the production day, are you just like, oh, I'm done?
Yeah.
Yeah, I am done. And look, I know now in the last few years, I will not go back to staying in a hotel again unless it has the kitchen. When in the early years, because my daughter was so small and I'm also OCD about what I feed my child, I really believe you set a person's eating patterns in the first 4 or 5 years of a life. So like, I'm not strict about other stuff with her that other parents might be, like a bedtime, but about food, I was really careful. And so even when we stayed at hotels, I would make the culinary team at Top Chef build me like a little ghetto kitchen, like literally like a conference table pushed against a wall. And I would have a hot plate. I would have 2 or 3 pans. I would have a blender and a toaster oven and a dorm fridge all put in. And we would cook. Like I would be washing, this is how you know where I'm from. I would be washing pots and pans in the bathtub of the hotel room. So I would make her rice and lentils.
I mean, that's like a lot of immigrant families. Like when we would go on vacation, parents would bring a rice cooker. They bring like and we cook in like a Best Western. And then like we'd be traveling with other families and everybody would have parties in our hotel room.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's like natural.
Exactly. So like in many cases, like these hotels, these fancy hotels, like the Driscoll smelled like curry for a good month. When we were filming, and I'm sure they're like, oh, you know, this TV host is coming, you know, with her old entourage that they love, the group of gypsies, you know, spotting from us.
Yeah, no, I was just wondering, I'm like, oh my gosh, she has to taste so much food. Like, especially at the very beginning when there's like 15 contestants and you do a quick fire, you do an elimination challenge. I was like, I don't know how she does it.
And you're the only, you're like the only judge who kind of eats everything, right? Because Tom isn't with you
Tom and Gil are with me half the days. They're, you know, on the elimination challenge, they're there, or whoever, if it's not Gail, whoever's subbing in for her. But yeah, I'm the only human being who eats every damn thing on Top Chef. And it's, you know, it's been hard. I mean, you know, 15 years ago, it was easier because I was younger. And it's not always easy. That's why I gained weight. I mean, you don't see it because I have a magician for a wardrobe. I'm serious, and we don't have that. I mean, we have a really decent budget, but we don't have a great big budget. So he's very creative, and you know, he's buying me dresses or jeans or whatever in 2 or 3 sizes, because you know, week after week, I'm just putting on weight, and you know, by the end of it, I can gain anywhere from 10 to 17 pounds. And it's not great, you know. You're not supposed to yo-yo like that every year, so I have to be really mindful so that like what it takes me 6 weeks to gain on Top Chef, it will take me 12 weeks to lose afterward.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're just like shocked.
I was just that's just something that I was like, I was, when I was watching it, I was like, oh my goodness, like this, like I was just wondering how you, like I wanted to know your secret, like how did she look this great and like she can eat whatever she wants and all that stuff. Like I was just, I was in awe.
I'll tell you how. I mean, you can also read my memoir, which you can tell but you know, which is called Love, Loss, and What We Ate. I guess I should say that since we're on a podcast. But you know what I do is I just make a deal with the biggest thing is psychological. I make a deal with myself and I say, this is part of your work and you need to do a good job at work, and you can, you know, as long as you're not doing anything unhealthy, too unhealthy, you can take care of your weight after. This is not about your vanity. This is about giving the contestants the full audience of your appetite. And then after that, it is being monitored by a doctor, which I have been for the last few years. It's also a drink that I make, which involves like pure cranberry juice and a vitamin C packet, like the unsweetened cranberry juice, vitamin C packet, some green tea with honey in it, because that cranberry juice is really tart, and also fiber powder. And so you mix all that up. And you drink, I drink that right before I go to work. And that kind of puts a base down, and I will eat, you know, have that like twice a day on a quick fire day, maybe two or three times on an elimination day. You know, I'm also, I carry a jump rope with me. So the reason I don't go out is that my time is so limited and I would rather spend it exercising, you know, and I'm in heels all day too. You know, I'm in heels on concrete. I mean, it's incredible when I'm talking to you about it, but I actually have done.
Girl, they put you through it.
I am just in awe of everything that you have to do. You make it look like,
I mean,
it's like nothing.
Thank you. I mean, you know, it's a high class problem to have, and I'm fully cognizant of that fact. But yes, it is a toll. And, you know, I'm a woman on TV, it's different. Nobody asked Tom how he stays in shape. You know, for women on television, it is a very, very different game. You know, I'm like a car you just drove off the lot. I'm a depreciating asset, you know, because television and Hollywood have different standards for women than they do for men as it relates to everything, but especially appearance. And that's not lost on you, you know, and that's why I have to be really mindful of all of what I eat and drink and how much I sleep and all of that. It doesn't leave a lot of time for anything but being with my kid. So I basically like film, sleep, play with Krishna, repeat. In fact, I work so many hours that Krishna also has a dressing room on set so that, you know, she can do her schoolwork and that she can, you know, keep a normal schedule. And, you know, thank God Bravo has been really supportive of my needs with that, you know. And it's also good because they're also run by women, so they understand.
Nice.
I love it. You got to make it work. So obviously the show is a very communal show. Like, you know, you share food, you go grocery shopping together. There's a lot of interaction with people, a lot of people. So for this season, because we're in a pandemic, how did you guys have to adjust with, like, you know, sharing plates or even how you guys adjust your approach just to make sure everybody was staying safe? Or
my gosh, there were so many things involved, and I have to, you know, give a lot of credit to my producers, because not only did they make the changes that were needed, but they made them very creatively. Like, I'm really happy that some of the solutions that we found to things, like, for instance, obviously we can't have a guest judge that's different, you know, from the community, because you needed to quarantine, and some people don't want to quarantine for two whole weeks just to come on for half a day for a quick fire, which I get. So what we did was we had a jury, which was comprised of alumni who were past contestants of seasons that had, were either fan favorite or finalists or winners. And they ate every meal with me and then with Tom and Gail and me when we were in the elimination challenge. And that was great fun. Like, that was an unintentional benefit of having to address these COVID protocols, because when was I going to have a family reunion being like that, where I had all these guys that I had spent so many weeks with on every year of Top Chef together under one roof for days and weeks on end. And it was also fun not to have to only always, you know, I had other people tasting finally that quickfire food too. and their opinion is really valuable. Their perspective is really great because they've been through the process. And, you know, to have like Nina Compton and Kristen Kish and Kwame and, you know, Richard. And
ooh, I'm excited to see them again. Yeah, yay.
You're gonna love it. It's so nice. It's really a very, very precious, it was a precious thing to me personally, but it's also a really wonderful, valuable addition to the show. So in that happy instance, you know, we did it for COVID, but I think it benefited the show immensely. It certainly made my time at work much more fun and enjoyable because also, you know, I'm meeting these guys at a very pivotal and strange time in their professional life. Like being on Top Chef is a life-changing experience. Ask anybody who's been a contestant. So I get really close to them, not all of them, but a handful of them, you know, every season, because I'm like a fifth grade teacher, you know, with a new batch of kids. And sometimes it's not even the best student that the teacher falls in love with. You know, it's the person who's the funniest or the person who can't get out of their own way or whatever. And so through 15 years of shooting this show, I have this beautiful second extended family. And I got to spend more time with Kwame and Gregory Corday and you know, all these other people too, like Melissa King, that I would have never had a chance to do otherwise.
Nice. I'm excited. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would ask, like, how did y'all handle grocery shopping and restaurant wars?
I'll tell you anything you want to know. I mean,
well, don't spoil restaurant wars yet, because that's like my favorite. Yeah, but like grocery shopping and like, because a lot of the episodes is like catered events, and I'm obviously you can't do that.
Well, the grocery shopping was a bummer. I will tell you that. Sorry, but you know they couldn't go to Whole Foods. At the end, I think they did go to some markets that we could clean, clear, and secure. But they had to do. It's also a sign of the times. They had to order their groceries. You know, and so then they came. And sometimes they're like, I would never pick this tomato. This is a terrible tomato.
That's part of the job.
When we order online. So that was a learning curve for them. Judge's table is not the regular judge's table. It's a huge ass horseshoe. Because you get 6 feet of a space. Again, a benefit for me, because I was always like fighting elbow room, you know, between all these people. And then God forbid we had two guest judges and it was five of us there, you know, because I sit in the center, believe it or not, I would always have to like straddle the middle legs of the guy.
Oh.
You know, and like, all this like unglamorous stuff that you never hear about. But so I want them to keep the horseshoe for next season because I had all the room in the world. You know, my art department was amazing. They built me this little caddy thing where I could put my drinks and my phone. Never had that before. Used to have an Apple box, nothing more, you know. And I could stand for the quick fires. I'm standing at judge's table, which is better for my posture anyway. But the only thing that
I was just going to say, it's going to be exciting to see these changes. I mean, they're a little bit bittersweet, but I think, like you said, it will reflect, like when we look back on this season, it will reflect the times.
Yeah,
right?
it would have been ridiculous.
I love how...
It would have been ridiculous It would have been ridiculous for us to do the show and ignore COVID or play it off like that wasn't going on. You know, the whole world was going through it. So, you know, and we thought COVID was going to be our greatest challenge. We didn't bank on civil unrest. We didn't bank on fires. You know, that was very, very scary.
Well, like speaking to that, you know, I follow you on Twitter and, you know, I love your voice. You are very vocal
when it comes to social issues and politics. And, you know, I posted, you did this a thing with a Phenomenal with, you know, Nick Dodani, and I love seeing kind of the South Asian kind of representation. I want to kind of go into what's been going on lately. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
It's okay. I know.
Yeah, it's hard.
You know, I was like, oh, when I talk about this, I'm gonna try not to get emotional.
How can you not? You know, that's what we're living through.
So, the violence against Asians right now. I'm sorry. you know, it's been disheartening, infuriating this whole past week, right? And it's opened, you know, this long overdue conversation about Asians, not only East Asians, Southeast Asians, you know, just all of us in this country. And it's kind of opened my eyes more in terms of what's been going on. And there's, you know, there's a lot to be said, right? And me and Amanda, we have these talks, and we, you know, I joined Clubhouse conversations, and we see all these panels, right? And at the same time, I'm like, oh, what else can be said? You know, it's like, bottom line is white supremacy has been and continues to be a problem, right? Not only for Asians, for the Black community, Latinx community, and everything, but, you know, how has this impacted you? And like, kind of, how have you navigated all of this? And, you know, I mean, I could ask you like, what have you done or what can we do? But it's like, that question seems so, you know, inauthentic now. It's like all, it seems like we've had this talk for over a year, and it took 8 people to die for people to pay attention, just like it took George Floyd and Breonna Taylor's death.
Like, are people actually paying attention? Because you're still seeing really weird sort of arguments that don't really add any solution to this issue.
You know, I was in kind of an altered state when I heard about Georgia, because, you know, I have a guy who's my driver, and he takes my family and I to and from the airport. And with COVID, you know, obviously I can't take a New York taxi or an Uber. So he's been driving us, like he's been driving my daughter just to school for safety, you know, when she's in hybrid. And his daughter, who I've been hearing about for the last 12 years, is 21. And she came home from work, and, you know, last week she had somebody throw acid in her face, and she's right now in intensive care. And we cannot figure out who did this or why to her. And then, you know, it was just, as a parent, it's, as a human being, you know, not even a parent, it is horrible. And I can't, I've never met Amia, but I know her so well, because I spent so many hours in the car with her father, and learning about her, learning about when she got into college and all of the things. And so, you know, it just, I can't stop thinking about her life and how she, right now, she can't see. And, you know, she can't speak because of the acid, and she's in a burn unit. And this is a normal, healthy, young woman who has her whole life ahead of her. And then the day after, I heard about what happened in Georgia. And what I find the most difficult is, honestly, how to manage my anger. I know it seems odd, but I cannot tell you when I heard that, no, it's not a hate crime, that it's a sex addiction. And I said, it's still a hate crime. It's not just Asians, it's women. It is gender-based violence. And for you to say that that's not a hate crime and that he had a bad day is insane.
Yeah.
It's really insane. And this is the guy who is supposed to protect us and is in charge of the investigation. And I mean, what chance do we have I am horrified, but I'm also shocked that any of us got this far with all of the things that were happening all along, way before Trump, all along underneath the surface. You know, I was raised in this country by my mom to be thankful, and I am thankful, to keep my head down, which I'm not doing anymore. And to just not cause waves and go about your business. And if people tell you no, just go around and find someone else who tells you yes, and not to expect, I guess, to be satisfied with less than what my white counterparts who, you know, also like me, have the same worries, have the same hopes and dreams. I was raised to just be happy for the little that I got. But, you know, are my dollars less green that I pay in taxes? Mm. You know, it's that thing. If you stab me, if you prick me, do I not bleed as red my blood? I just don't understand. You know, when they say this isn't, but to me it's intersectional, you know, it's Asian hate, which is the product of other kinds of hate that came before it. And this is not new, okay?
This is
bias and racism and Asian hate is not new. There was a, you know, Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882. And before that, there was the Page Act. And then there was the Japanese internment.
What is it, like a massacre in like a Chinatown or something a long time ago? It was like one of the biggest massacres.
Yeah, it was the biggest lynchings of
And you know, I mean, you know, we had to look into a lot of this painful stuff for Taste the Nation because it's a show about immigrants. I mean, Taste the Nation is just like a political show, you know, masquerading as a food show. So I was looking at a lot of this,
which is good.
Well, you know, I was looking at a lot of this research, and so I had it in my head. And you know, that's the thing. This is state-sanctioned, state-encouraged misogyny, xenophobia, and racism. I've been telling it to anybody who will listen. There's a great book called Caste by Isabel Wilkerson. And I think this book should be required reading for every high school student in the American school system. It is comparing Jim Crow and segregation laws to Nazi Germany, to the Indian caste system as well. So they, you know, they talk about Asian society. I mean, that is what they talk least about. But you know, even within Asian cultures, we have to be clear-eyed about how we have internalized the racism of our colonial oppressors. And also that the caste system predates our colonial oppressors. You know, that caste system was not a product of colonialism. It goes back centuries. And I think, I think all racism and prejudice is fear-based. I think it's learned, but I think it is fear-based. And I think even white supremacy is also fear-based because They are afraid that they're going to lose their land, their money, their power to brown and black folk, you know, whatever kind of brown you are, brown and black folk, because that's what they did or their ancestors did when they came here. We have to remember that America was a brown country to start with. And people forget that.
And a lot of people forget that.
And so I have started now to refer to Caucasian people not as Caucasian, because that is inaccurate, to refer to them as European American, because that is what they are, you know.
That's accurate.
That's right. Why do I have to qualify myself as an Asian or an Indian American, but they just get to say American? Like,
yeah. Oh my gosh, I never even thought about that. Like, we have
to help me spread the trend, you know?
Yeah, we will. European Americans. European American privilege.
But that's what it is.
this is all part of this idea, that this is all part of the reason why we are where we are, and the sort of the thoughts of that that we have. And we do, and we do need to be cautious. And I like what you said about sort of like Asians, like looking into and looking at the sort of the subconscious bias that was put on them from their from the white people, basically. Yeah.
Because it's, I think the whole thing about white proximity.
A lot of black people were like, mm-hmm. oh, you know, there's a history of Asians mistreating black people. You see in China, like a lot of them are black people that visit China are oftentimes discriminated against. But the fact of the matter is, this is not something that is we can advocate for one group and not for. We need to. I'm of the mind. We need to advocate for
everyone.
Right. We need to advocate for equality. We need to advocate for all these things that are not just going to benefit the Black community, but benefit all the marginalized communities. Because that's the only way we can actually win. Right. Right. Like,
you can't pull some people out of the swamp and not others, and say that there are no people in the swamp. There are,
because the white is not a black. It's a race issue, and there's different races, and we all need to come together. And that's sort of what our focus needs to be. So I love that you said that, because I've been talking to my black friends, and a lot of them are like, you know what? I'm going to be honest. It's hard for me to have sympathy for what's happening to the Asian community. And I was telling Dino, like, when the Georgia thing happened, it was literally like I was done for the day. Like I was it.
Yeah,
I
me too.
Like I was, this reminds me of what happened. Like we talked about, this was the same thing that happened in Charleston, right? Mm-hmm. At the church, you know, like everything, there's similar threads in everything. That's why this has to be a together thing. That's why it can't be in silos, right?
But I would say it's even beyond race. Like, yes, race, it is intersectional in the truest, broadest meaning of the word intersectional, because it's not just about racism or sexism. It's about gun control, because no matter what the reason this guy decided he was going to kill these people, if he didn't have the firearm to do it, we wouldn't be sitting here with 8 less people walking the earth. That's all there is to it. And the reason that we don't have gun control is because of voting law. You know, they just passed a whole bunch of voting laws because they're so scared and they don't want to accept the races in Georgia, and they don't want to accept the legitimacy of the presidential race. So they're trying to put more and more and more restrictions. It's like, why the hell do we have Columbus Day? Why don't we have a national day where everybody's off and everyone just goes and votes? Like, we
can
like what? No.
And have the access to vote.
Yeah, and you have to ask yourself why the people who, you know, why don't people want as many people to vote? You know, those people, because they know they're not going to be voted for. That's why.
Yeah. Also, like, why do you want not as many people to vote, but as many people to have access to weapons? You know, we're okay with restrictions over here, and because of all this stuff and people that like are misinformed, but you're not okay with putting restrictions for something that has proven to harm people multiple times. I think what are we at, 200 and something mass shooting by this year? It's ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense. It just sounds so backwards. Like we're worried about the wrong thing here.
I mean, I just don't get it. Yeah. And you know, I am a big hater of Ted Cruz. I will openly say that I try to find new
creative
ways to kill him.
Protect it.
But I mean, when I saw yesterday when he was saying, like, every time we have a mass shooting, this situation comes up in this committee, and you know, it doesn't make crime drop, it makes it raise. I'm like, how does it do that exactly? He's never specific about that. You know, like I find a new way to dislike this man every day, every time he opens his mouth.
We can definitely find some type of solution.
It's horrible. It's horrible.
Like this happened. Say, oh, this is just sort of what's going to happen. You know, like we can't. Like there has to be a way to. I know we probably can't stop this stuff, but there has to be a way to at least like curb the numbers.
Control.
Yeah, control. Like, but to tell you, you know, how the magnitude of the problem. The day after those women were killed in Georgia, and then, you know, those 8 people. 172 Republican lawmakers voted against the Violence Against Women Act.
Yeah.
I just don't understand how, like, I think it's a lot to pride and like this dedication to this party that is so antiquated and so ignorant. And like, someone tweeted that, like, someone tweeted a while back, it's like, oh, the Constitution was written how many years ago? I think it's time
for like the founding fathers didn't want. It was so, yeah.
And I think one of the things is just like, Hari Kondabolu said something, he tweeted something that is just like, so standing out to me. He's like, oh, you pushed us to the margins and now you're surrounded.
That's right.
Yeah. And I was just like, really, it's true. It's like, oh, maybe it's time for y'all to surrender, you know, because they literally are surrounded.
Yeah.
And like, I was just, I tweeted this earlier today and I was like, imagine if Asians and Asian Americans in this country walked out one day of their jobs. Yeah. Imagine who's if gonna all run people Google? Of color walked out.
Who's gonna run anything? No, but let's be honest. Like, who's gonna run anything? Like, there's so many immigrants. This country runs on the backs of immigrants.
It was built on immigrant labor.
But it still continues to run on the back of immigrants. Like, all the person that made the vaccine wasn't she like an immigrant too? I don't know if that's true. But I think she was.
Yeah.
But I'm like, there's so many things that we've contributed to this country. It makes zero sense while we're still asking for equality, while we're still asking
for them not to kill us,
while we're still asking for our lives. Like, it doesn't make any sense. We've done our contribution and we've done it with little in return. Mm-hmm. What is the issue with us now wanting
to be? Because it's not pride. We like to think it's pride, like Juno was saying, but it's actually power. It's power. It's not pride. Yeah. If they had any pride, they wouldn't speak and act so shamefully.
Yeah.
You know.
God, it's so. Yeah, we could go.
Oh my God.
We could.
Just talking about this. But since we're running out of time, let me just ask you. So you mentioned Taste the Nation. I know it's coming back for season two. What can you tell us about season two?
Well, I can tell you that we have to wait until later in the spring to shoot it because we want a little bit more saturation with the vaccine. Look, you know, Top Chef has like 10 times the crew of Taste the Nation, but Taste the Nation, I'm going into different houses and, you know, backyards or restaurant kitchens. And I just want to make sure that all of, not only my crew and I are safe, but my participants are safe. And that is a traveling show where I'm never in the same place twice. So, you know, we are going to shoot. I'm in the process of getting vaccinated. I'll be fully vaccinated next week. And then, you know, there'll be a waiting period. But also, I want enough of the populations where we're going into to be vaccinated. And, you know, a lot of people that I'm talking to on Taste the Nation may not have great access to healthcare and things like that. We're going to start off by doing a few episodes in the spring that we'll hopefully put on air before the end of the calendar year. And then we'll continue to do more shows beyond that of second season that probably will not be ready in time until 2022. But listen, I want to get back to work. Like, that's my jam. You know, I love going into discovering different communities and getting to know people. And, you know, I grew up in an immigrant community, so these are my people, whether they're Thai or Persian or whatever. So I just want to get back on the road, but I don't want to diminish the quality of what we've established in the first season. It took me so long to get it done. I'm so thankful and grateful for the enormous positive feedback that we've gotten from viewers and the media and critics and stuff, but I don't want to squander that just because I'm in a hurry to shoot. I don't want the trail to go cold. I want to put out as many episodes as quickly as I can, but not if the show, because the show is dependent on intimacy, you know? We're talking about some really serious things, you know? I mean, Top Chef is like this big, beautiful circus of a show that, you know, is very formatted and is very big and has competition and all that. Taste the Nation is the antithesis. It's not the antithesis, it's just different than that, because it's an intimate show. It's about very going into, you know, granular conversations about different things. And so we will get to it. It will be on before the end of the year, but it just may be, you know, a handful of episodes, and then the rest will come out in 2022.
So Papa, just to end our session, we like to do this segment we call the facts or the FAQs, just kind of fun questions. So the first question is, what has been your go-to junk food during this pandemic?
Well, it's not just this pandemic, but I love potato chips. I love spicy potato chips, like jalapeno potato chips.
I love any fried potato product. I'm down. Give me a potato. That's all. Okay, you don't have to answer this, but how often do people come up to you and bug you about glitter?
Not often enough, Dino. Thank you for bringing that up. Okay.
Really?
No, I'm joking.
You like when
let's make this your stage. Okay. How, you know, do you like people coming up to you to talk about?
I like people coming up to me talking to me about anything, because I want human connection, and I always can tell what people's interests are by what they mention first. So, you know, I have a pretty big gay fan base, which I'm very
And glitter is
in my wheelhouse, and I'm very thankful for that. You know, it's a fan base I covet quite deeply, and so, you know, they will often bring that up, or like I have a lot of Trekkie fans because I was in Star Trek. So I know who the Trek people are, because they come up to me to talk about Princess Kaitama, and is it true that I was a descendant of Fompa Jansen's character? So like they are really serious about that stuff. And so, you know, then there are people who come up to me about Love, Loss, and What We Ate, because they're book people, or my cookbooks, or, you know, when I did my first show on the Food Network 20 years ago. And then, you know, there's some people that just like my bikini pictures, which, you know, are becoming fewer and fewer with the seasons of Top Chef becoming greater and greater, you know?
Well, I just didn't realize that you have such kind of like this swath of fandom, because like the Star Trek, you know, even on the Drag Race episode you were on, RuPaul was all glitters. One of my favorite episodes.
We are a big Drag Race house. RuPaul is a friend who's been here, you know, for dinner, and my daughter and I just eat that up. I mean, my daughter can tell you the names of way many more queens than I can, because
she's greater than 11 years. That's so fun. It could be like one of those like taste offs in Top Chef, but name.
Oh my God! What if there was a Top Chef Drag Race crossover?
That would be awesome.
Okay. Okay. If we asked the people who knew you best, what's Padma's worst habit? What would they say?
I am a bit of a perfectionist. I can be a little OCD about stuff. Mm-hmm. And I run about 15 minutes late.
Okay. Well, that's kind of standard for people of color, right?
Yeah, I'm on Indian Standard Time, exactly. That's brown folk time.
Well, actually, I'm the annoying friend that's always 5 minutes early or 10 minutes early. And I'm like standing there waiting with my foot tapping.
But I think they would say I'm persnickety. You know, I'm like, it depends who you ask. Like, you know, if you're asking my showrunner on Top Chef, she'll tell you that I'm very persnickety about commas, like my grammar. Because when I get the script, and it's not a scripted show, and the only time we have anything scripted is when I'm giving the challenge to the contestants, because it's also the first time and only time that the audience at home is hearing it. So it's very important for that to be clear and concise and really explicit. And so, you know, I look at the script that comes to me once they've figured everything out, and then I will mark it up and I'll send it back. And then I'll, you know, so like I, you know, I'm a grammar.
With people and their when they misspell or misuse words, I just want to write them back. I'm like, this is what you meant, all right? But I'm like, let me not.
This is why,
you know, about not misspelling stuff or anything. But but it's just their writing, right? And then I'll do a pass and I'll rewrite just things because I'm making sure that when you say things out loud, you know, it's different. And so it's also different for different people. Like I have my particular cadence. And that's another thing. People have often recognized me when they're sitting behind me in restaurants. They recognize me when they hear me order because they recognize my voice.
Your voice is very distinguishable. You have one of those recognizable voices.
Yeah.
I mean, like when it comes to grammar, I'm kind of the same way. And even like when I'm tweeting, this is when an edit button on Twitter helps because I have typos all the time in Twitter. But by the time it's kind of already out there, and I'm like, oh, damn it. Now I have to go back and make a correction in like the ad tweet portion. I'm very particular about that. Okay. So you are stranded on a deserted island and you have all you need to survive, right? But you have a DVD player as your only source of entertainment and are allowed one movie, not a TV series, just one movie to watch. What is it?
You know, if I thought about it, it might be something else. But when you said that, the first thing that came to my mind is Out of Africa, directed by Sydney Pollack, beautiful, with Robert Redford and Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
And her costume is so beautiful.
That's a good one.
The cinematography talks about colonialism in a very subtle way.
Yes.
That time, the 80s. There's a beautiful line in that movie where Robert Redford comes back to her after, you know, wherever he's gone and come back from. And she says to him, you know, it's a kind of a darkened room where they're sitting. There may have even been a fireplace. And she's saying, there are things in this life of value and they come at a price. I am one of them. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I was like, go!
That line!
I'm about to when we're done. That's a good line. Okay.
That is a good line.
Would you rather never be stuck in traffic again or never get another cold?
You cut out. Never be stuck in traffic again or
never get another cold.
That's a hard one. I think I would never be stuck in traffic again because sometimes when you have a cold, it's a good excuse to get out of things and watch
TV. Yeah.
Or read. That's what day in bed.
So, that's exactly what I was going to say. Especially with
that. That is good.
It would be nice to never have to deal with traffic ever again.
Yeah.
Okay. And our final question, we ask this to all of our guests, is there an underrepresented voice in the industry, actor, writer, producer, any creator that is not mainstream that you think people need to know about or you just want to give more shine to and recognition to?
Oh yeah, I think there's a lot. How much time have you got? You saved this one for the last month.
Name as many as you want.
Yeah, I think there are. I think that we need to hear from, it's not one person, but I think we need to hear from different points of view. I think I would love for people in power who have the power to green light movies and TV shows in Hollywood, since this is Deadline, I would love them to green light shows by people who don't look like them and don't have their same frames of reference, because I think that is the way forward for more interesting stories, not just because it's ethically the right thing to do, but you have no idea how much you inspire and have influence over the next generation of people watching your programming. And I think Ali Wong should have a show of her own, like a regular show of her own.
Wasn't there a news today that she got a show? Netflix got greenlit a show for her.
Her and Stephen Yeun are doing the eighth
show. Great, God must have been in my mind because she already did what I wanted.
Wow, yeah.
I also think Michelle Buteau is funny as fuck and should get some more.
She's been on the podcast. We love her. We love Michelle.
And you know, I think in general, I think we need to see more mainstream queer stories as well. You know, you have Love, Simon on Hulu, you have Will and Grace, but I think you just need more of that. And I think we need to see more children who are transitioning in sitcoms, because that is, you know, something that we need to normalize, you know, just as like, they're not strange. They're having a very strange experience that is so profound because they feel that they're in the wrong, you know, gender, right? They're in the wrong body.
That, yeah.
And that is a very painful thing to feel. You know, we know what it's like just to feel like a fish out of water in another culture. Imagine what that's like. And I think just normalizing, you don't have to take a big political stand. It doesn't have to be anything dramatic or controversial. It just has to show like a fifth grader whose name is Jane, but is always wants to be in pants. You know what I mean? We have to do it.
Yeah.
Like you can't just deal with this stuff when you're an adult. Like everything, I'm a parent and it's a big part of my life. And I think everything has to be introduced to your child in an age appropriate way as soon as possible. So it doesn't have this like, you know, really charged energy to it when you do find out, you know, you should, as a person, you should be entertained as a child, as an adult, in a thoughtful way. And I think the only way to do that is to have auteurs and content providers who are bringing you those differences of perspective that exist, that coexist and are already here, you know, in the next building, across the street, in the next town. It's not something that you have to go, you know, to Siberia to come and bring here. It is something that we live among. So let's see that on TV. Let's see that in the movie.
Yeah.
I am here.
Definitely.
I'm so here for it. Thank you so much, Padma, for being here with us. You are amazing. Like I said, I'm in awe of what you do and I cannot wait.
Yeah, we all are.
Yeah. I can't wait for the next season.
I really appreciate that. What a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah. Can't wait for the season and to eat more. So good. Thank you so much, Padma.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.